Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, May All Our Thoughts, Words, and Deeds Serve and Please You, presented by Gary Grafwalner, disc number GRG-2005-04.
Today is June 20th, and my name is Gary Grafwalner, and this is a fourth in a series of classes on prayer. And I'm just kind of curious, how many of you heard the first session on the Desert Elders last week? None of you did. Okay. All righty. That'll make a difference in what we do today.
Are those on tape so we can catch up?
Yeah.
Okay.
They are. Richard Foster is a Quaker. You know, I think before I talk, I want to pray. And I'd like to teach you this song. And it comes from the Iona community. And I think it's written by Mr. Bell. And it goes like this. Take, oh, take me as I am. Summon up what I shall be. Set your seal upon my heart and live in me. As I am, summon up what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart, and live in me. Two more times we'll pray it. Take, oh, take me as I am, summon up what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart and live in me. Take, oh, take me as I am. Summon up what I shall be. Set your seal upon my heart and live. That's a prayer I pray every day when I'm walking, as a way of kind of opening myself to God and offering who I am, and then inviting the Spirit to set her seal on my heart and to live in me and to transform me. Richard Foster is a Quaker, and among his many books was one called Everflowing Streams. And what he does is he looks at what he calls primary qualities in Jesus' life, and then he shows how they're carried into the early church and the medieval church and the church today. And he says one of the qualities is to be a holiness person, and there's a holiness tradition. And it's about the virtuous life. And one is to be a charismatic, to be a spirit-filled person. And that's about living in the Spirit. And one is to be word-centered. You've heard it said, but I say to you. And Lutherans are word-centered. Certainly there's overlap between these. One is a social justice tradition. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to bring good news to the poor, release to the captives, sight to the blind, healing, etc. One is the contemplative tradition, the prayer tradition. Jesus would go off and he'd pray early in the morning, he'd get up, or he'd pray all night long. And the desert Abbas are part of the contemplative tradition. They're part of the prayer tradition. And they're one way to pray. And this class is based on something that's called watchfulness of thoughts. It's a little technique. It's new for me, but I'm kind of excited about it. And I'm interested in prayer, and I've studied prayer. I've practiced prayer for a long time. And no one's ever told me about this stuff. Or maybe I was just distracted. But Kathleen Norris gives a great plug to this book and writes in the foreword. And this is by Mary Margaret Funk, and it's in the bookstore. And there was a sequel of hers called Not Only Thoughts Matter, But Tools Matter. And she has a summary of this in about 5 pages. But she has lots of different ways to pray. And I commend them both to you. I think they're just wonderful resources. They could be great for a book study, a co-ed book study, women only, men only, with youth, etc. The desert Abbas are really teachers. They're sages, whether they're male or female. And they were active in the 4th, 5th, and 6th century, mostly in Egypt and Palestine and Syria. And they left an incredible volume of material, sermons, letters, essays, sayings, stories, biblical commentaries, and they are very suspect of strong doctrinal statements. So often they say something and they give you only part of it. And then you've got to figure it out, you know, and it's pretty obvious where they're going. What they did was they withdrew from the hedonism and the materialism and the immorality of their day. And they felt they wanted to kind of push away all the distractions and to come apart like we come to Holden, or maybe some people go to Iona or to another holy place, you know, to be people that are reflective. Before I came to the village, I talked with a young man who is living in the Dominican Republic. His name is Jerome, and he's a Peace Corps volunteer, and he'll finish up his service there in November. And when Jerome left, he weighed 168 pounds, and he was solid. He was solid. And in 2 months, he lost 20 pounds. 2 months, 20 pounds. Maybe 3 months, 20 pounds. And now he's about 140 pounds. 142, something like that. And he was back for a break before he went back to the Dominican Republic, and he's working to help indigenous people develop their own industries, and he's working particularly around bread baking. And he said, you know, in the Dominican Republic, he said, all I have are my clothes and my books. That's all I have. I don't have a TV. I don't have a DV player. I don't have electricity. I don't have a computer. I don't have a cell phone. He said, I am unplugged. And when people say to me, well, I try and meditate maybe a half hour, an hour a day. He said, I have so much time. And he said, I don't meditate for a day, I meditate for a week, I meditate for a month, I've been meditating for a year and a half. He said, there aren't a lot of distractions here. I do my job and I come home. You know, I work with the people and I come home. The Abbas and the Imas were about getting unplugged, about figuring out what to say no to and stepping back and being countercultural. Many people came to them, rulers, generals, mothers, fathers, priests, for wisdom. The earliest Abba we know is a man by the name of St. Anthony in 269 AD, so it's pretty early. He was Egyptian, he was raised a Christian, and one day he heard the parable of the rich fool read. And it really touched his heart. And he thought, that's me and Jesus. And so he gave away most of his inheritance. And he kept just enough for his sister and himself to live on. And then he heard some other stories in the gospel. And he gave away what was his. And he made sure his sister was cared for by some other women. And he became what's called the first Christian solitary. He moved out of society to go deeper with God. And that's one model for the elders. Another model is by Pachonius. And he was raised a pagan. And he was conscripted into Constantine's army. And they were held in a dungeon with no food and no clothes until they were ready to be sent to battle. And some Christians came into the dungeon and fed them and brought them medicinal aids and comforted them. And he said, if I ever get out of here, I'm not going to follow Constantine. I'm going to follow Christ. And he became a Christian when he was released. And he founded the first religious communities of the desert Abbas in Egypt, up the Nile, in a place called Tabernius. So his model is communal. Anthony's model is solitary. There were also people who gathered around someone who was a teacher just to learn their way of life. So they would gather for a certain period of time around someone like Abba Moses or Abba Arsenius, who were elders. And there were women who took up this life. And sad to say, some but not all of their wisdom is preserved, because the women were separated from the men. It was a male-dominated society. And the women were viewed as a distraction by at least some men. But Pachamus started the first monasteries, the communal settlements of women in the desert tradition. And this is the vision. This is the vision that drives the elders. Two things. If you would be perfect, go sell what you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. And for the elders to be perfect meant to be loving. To love God with all one's heart, one's soul, one's mind, and one's strength. It wasn't a burden. It was an invitation, and it was a choice. One of my Jesuit teachers said, the greater love must order the lesser loves. And anything other than God is a lesser love. Boyfriend, girlfriend, children, grandchildren, golf, fishing, sports cars. The greater love orders the lesser loves. And that's what these people were about. The goal was to be fully loving, loving of God, and God's image in other people.
Turn it a little flatter, so.
No,
this way.
Just the angle.
Yeah, the angle.
Okay, is that?
Thanks.
Sorry. So everything is measured by love. By this they will know you are mine, by the way you love. Not by what you teach, but by what you do and say. They also stressed humility, and humility did not mean low self-esteem. It didn't mean cringing, but it meant an attitude of the heart that saw other people the way God sees them, as created in the divine image and valued. John Cassian, who was from an area that today we call Romania, 360 to 435 AD, is the person who has really recorded a lot of the wisdom of the desert elders. And he influenced Benedict, who started the rule of St. Benedict like 100 years later, and subsequent monastics. And there are three renunciations that John talks about that the elders practice. The first is, when you become a follower of Jesus, you die to your old way of life and you rise to a new way of life. And so the first renunciation is you renounce your old way of life. You renounce status and stuff and titles and anything that would set you apart, you know, that would puff you up. One of the village staffers who's gone now, when I was here in May, said, you know, when people get off the bus at Holden and they're oriented, it goes something like this. Lunch will be served in the dining hall and at 1:15, And there's no smoking except on the porch of Lodge da da da. And if the fire bell rings, then if you go to this place, and if it's in your building, you get out pronto, just, you know, as quickly as you can. Don't feed the animals. He said, what if we said to people when they got off the bus, we are so glad you're here, and we are going to transform you while you're here. We want to change your life so that when you go back down the mountain, you will be a world changer. Now, some people come here hurting, some people come here seeking, some people come here tired. But it made me stop and think. I know some people I've talked to have come here to be transformed, and they've said, you know what, I really haven't been transformed. You know, I go to worship, we talk about community, and there are little communities, but I really haven't been transformed the way I thought I would. And that may be partly their own perception of things, but it may be partly the reality of the community. Well, the elders said, if you become a follower of Jesus, you make a break with your old way of life. That's the first renunciation. The second renunciation is you begin to notice your thoughts. Because the elders discovered when they went into the desert and they withdrew from society, their thoughts still came with them. And some thoughts mucked up their relationship with God and themselves and each other. So the noticing of thoughts and that prayer practice, which is what we're going to talk about today. And then the third renunciation, as you're growing in faith, is you renounce your concepts of God. You renounce your images of God. And God becomes the great mystery. Here we're naming God. Here we're naming God. Here, I can remember directing a woman, and she was going through this process, and she said, and I said to her, Nancy, what's your image of God like? And she thought, and she thought, and she said, it's sort of like looking through a kaleidoscope. It's just all this color. There's pattern, but it's just all this beauty, and it changes, and it's awesome. And another time I talked to her, and she said, oh, my image of God has changed. And she said, God is like a Siberian tiger. Massive, strong, regal, powerful. And another time she said, God is like the ocean. I'm just trying to get wet. So that's the third renunciation. Before I talk about thoughts, I want to stop and see if you have any questions. Okay, yeah?
Are there people today who are following you in this Abba tradition?
There are.
And are there communities there, or individuals?
They're both. Some, the Sisters of St. Clair on Vancouver Island at Duncan are a little monastic community of probably 8 women, and their work is hospitality and prayer, and you can go there and you can do their prayers with them, and you can eat with them, but you're out in a little hermitage, a little one-room cabin with a bed and a desk and a table and a chair, and that's about it, and whatever else you might bring. And they're all over the country. Christ in the Desert, in the high country, I think it's Arizona, it might be New Mexico, is a place to come apart, Benedictine, monastic tradition, to be still. You know, the Abba said, if you go into yourself, everything will become plain to you. If you wait on God, if you're open to God. So there are people like that. And part of the reason I should tell you why I wanted to teach this is a former parishioner of a congregation I served started Stanford on a full ride as a presidential scholar to become a physician. And she was a double major in biology and the humanities. And she went to El Salvador and she was introduced to liberation theology and land reform and the option for the poor. And then she worked with a chaplain for a while in a hospital. And so she got into that and she did some CPE. And she decided to go to Harvard Divinity School. And I kept in touch with her through the years. And as she was getting ready for graduation, she said, "I don't know whether to go on for my PhD and teach in a seminary or college or going to the parish." And I said, "Oh, Laura, you got to come into the parish. We need people like you, people who are bright and sensitive and pastoral." So her first parish, her husband's a Presbyterian pastor, was way out in eastern Oregon. And I said to the bishop, "You've got to get this lady out of eastern Oregon." And now she's in Portland. And she serves half-time in a congregation called the Lutheran Church of Atonement, or the Mission of the Atonement, the Lutheran Church of the Mission of the Atonement. And it's a Roman Catholic Lutheran congregation. She serves with a priest. She serves half-time. She's a mother. And I've watched her grow through the years. And last fall when I worshiped with them, I just noticed a change in her. I mean, she's always been bright and thoughtful, but there was just sort of a quietness to her. And I said, "What's happening to you?" And she said, "Well, I am one of 29 women clergy in the United States who've been asked to go to a Benedictine abbey in Indiana to study prayer. And we go for 10 days, three times a year, for 2 years." And so when I talked to her next, I said, "How are things with the Romans, with the sisters?" And she said, "Gary, they are so amazing." And I said, "What are you reading?" And she said, "I'm reading Thoughts That Matter and Tools That Matter and one other book." So I went out and I bought the books and I read them and I thought, yeah, I know why you're going deeper. So that's why I wanted to share this with you. It's really kind of new for me. I'm trained primarily by the Jesuits, a little bit by the Benedictines and the Franciscans. But I think that we ought to be able to use all the resources that are across the traditions of the church, because not each of us pray in the same way. And most of us at a different time in our life pray in a different way, or we stop praying. So it's Lori Larson of the Mission of the Atonement Lutheran Congregation in Southwest Oregon that kind of brought this stuff up for me. Roberta Bondi, I pulled this off my shelf after I read these books by Lori, is a professor of church history. She's a Methodist. She's at Emory University. And in 1985-88, she came out to love it with this book, To Love as God Loves. And it's all about the Desert Abbas. And I had it on my shelf, and I thought, one day I'm going to read that. You know? You have books like that? And I pulled it off, and it fit in with the material that Lori introduced me to.
And actually, Roberta was here and did much of this as lectures, so if you'd like to go and listen to tapes.
Great.
I don't know if you've ever met her, but she has this great thick Southern accent. So to hear her do this stuff is very... very wonderful. They don't hear in your ear what you expect.
Really?
The accent is kind of, oh my goodness.
A treat.
Yeah. What is the last name?
Roberta Bondi, B-O-N-D-I. So she's a Methodist theologian, has written an autobiography and some other material. So, if you get to Portland, one service, Sunday morning, check out the Mission of the Atonement in Southwest. You'll have a good experience.
Southwest where?
Southwest Portland.
Yeah.
Shoals Ferry Road. I can't give you any more than that. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. Our theme for this year is take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. Moses was working when he experienced the divine call. He noticed something, he was distracted, he paused, he turned aside to check it out, and his life changed. He heard the word, he was transformed by the word, and he became a liberator who led the people out of Egypt. And not only his life changed, but his thoughts changed. You know, his ideas of God changed, or the gods. And one of the things that struck me is in Martin Luther's morning prayer, he says something like this: "Oh God, I give thanks that you brought me safely through the night and protected me from harm and delivered me from all evil. And I pray that in this new day, all my thoughts, words, and deeds may serve and please you." That's a paraphrase. And I thought, you know, I've never heard anyone in the church talk about thoughts. I've heard them talk about words changing as we follow Christ, or deeds changing, but not thoughts. And then I noticed in the service of confession, it says, "I confess to you that I've sinned against you in thought, word, and deed." And in some of the other services, thoughts kept coming up. And I thought, why don't we talk about thoughts? Gary, why don't you talk about thoughts? You know? So, a little push. Thoughts matter. And our psychology and our cosmology is different than the desert elders. But they had what they called the passions or the afflictions. And they said there are passions that enter the body through three doors. So it's through the body. And these are food, sex, and things. And passions enter the mind through two doors, anger and depression. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And thoughts enter the soul through acedia, which is kind of, could be translated, just a spiritual weariness. You don't care to pray anymore. Scripture doesn't speak to you. Worship is flat, or vainglory, or pride. And one of the things the elders said is that these are in descending order of difficulty. As we grow in, Wesley would say, holiness, sanctification, growing in grace, that it's much easier to deal with food or sex or stuff than it is to deal with anger or soul weariness or pride. That this is the most difficult to deal with. And we'll look at that tomorrow. So today, I want to share some things with you around anger. And I want to begin by saying, when you get angry, what happens? What happens when you get angry? How do people know you're angry?
Touchy,
kind of super sensitive?
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else?
Avoiding people.
Avoiding people, just kind of pull back? Okay, anybody else?
There's a physical response, too.
Gut, neck, back? Yeah, okay. Any others?
Energy waiting to be expended.
Energy waiting to be expended. Sometimes, not always. Anything else?
Muttering under my breath.
Muttering under my breath. Okay, yeah. Within the desert tradition, and I want to, let me ask another question just to kind of check out your experience. What happens in your relationships with people when you're angry? And you've already indicated that in some ways. But what else happens?
Deteriorates.
Huh?
deteriorates.
It deteriorates? Like, for example?
People want to avoid you in some ways.
Okay. I don't, and you're always free to pass if I ask you a question and you don't want to answer. Yeah. Anything else?
I think it builds. Once I'm angry with someone, then I only see the things that contribute to my being angry. And I see everything else through that
lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it also is a little bit contagious, so it spreads.
Ah, yeah. It's like a virus.
Yeah.
It's
so if catching. I'm angry with you, then I'm probably going to be angry with this person too.
Or you'll help them be angry.
Yeah, that's right.
Triangle or...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here are some of the things that the elders say about anger. Number one, that anger blinds us. It blinds us. We can't see things clearly. Number two, and it's hard to pray when you're angry. And they're about prayer. They believe that grace comes through prayer. Not only through sacraments, not only through creation, not only through scripture, not only through community, but through prayer. And they say when you're angry, it's hard to pray. When we're angry, it's hard to worship. You know, do not let the sun go down on your anger. Have you ever come into anger, into worship angry? Snarling in the car at the kids or the parents or your partner, you know. And it builds. It builds. And they would say anger generates anger. Anger tends to take us out of relationship with God, with our best self, with others. This is hard for me, and so I want to balance this. But they, within the desert tradition, there's no such thing as righteous anger. I'll say that again. In the desert tradition, there's no such thing as righteous anger. That's different from the prophetic tradition, for sure, you know. Because they felt that again, the goal is to be loving. And how can we be loving when we're raging? You know? Toward God or with others. The fundamental goal is purity of heart, and it's to be mindful of our thoughts. And they said, when we get a little bit angry, we have a choice as to whether or not we're going to feed that. Or we can grab that thought by the tail, this is an image of an Abba, and just throw it aside and say, I'm not going to go there. So I had an example this last week. Someone who was supposed to set some things up for me when I came into the village hadn't set them up because they were doing a job for someone else who has had a health crisis. And so I went to this person, and I said, you know, this isn't happening, and that hasn't happened. And she said, it's not my problem. And I just instantly, I thought, okay, you know? And she said, fix it yourself. And so I said, okay. And so someone bailed me out. And I brought her flowers later. Because she was just an angel of mercy. She did something for me I couldn't do for myself. And then I thought about this person who had said this to me. And I started to pray for her, you know? And I just thought, God, I was initially really angry with her and ready to offer a retort back, but I thought, where did that come from? She's doing her job for the first time. She's overstressed. She's tired. She's got lots of demands on her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was able to let go. Let go. But I didn't want to be in the room with her for a while. For 2 days, I didn't want to be near her. When I saw her, I sort of looked away. Anger feeds anger. Gandhi says an unjust means gets you an unjust end. You know? I come from a large extended family, Germans on one side, Norwegians on the other. And I learned that two of my uncles had not talked for 23 years. And my mother doesn't know why. And that is Scandinavian stubbornness, you know? But it's also, it's holding on to this anger, you know? One did something to the other, one felt hurt or was hurt. And one of the things the elders say is when you hurt someone or they perceive that you've hurt them, it's really important to go to them because the relationship is worth maintaining. And that it's hard sometimes when you know, you've done something against them and they're raging at you. But the goal is to be the fully loving person. The goal is to act out of the heart that is God-filled, not out of a heart that is filled with rage. Not easy. Not easy. Dr. Katz, who's a Jewish psychiatrist, a group of us used to meet with in Missoula, Montana, said, your mind is like a field. If you put negative thoughts into your mind, you'll get weeds. Interesting. If you put positive thoughts into your mind, you'll get grain. You won't get weeds. Or there won't be as many weeds. I'm going to stop here to see any questions so far. Or can the people say amen? Or you're all wet? Or you know?
I have a question.
Sure.
So why did God give us the anger emotion then if we don't need it? Then we should deny it.
Yeah. Psychologists would say that anger repressed comes out one way or another. And you have to express the anger one way or another, not stuff it. The Abbas, the elders, would say, if you're angry, it's important to express the anger. But express the anger as best you can in a compassionate way. In a way that doesn't decimate the other person. It needs to be expressed. And when you act justly, you act compassionately. You overcome evil with good. You love your enemy. You blow their mind with kindness. So if you've ever heard Desmond Tutu, he has this gracious, playful way of just speaking the truth to people who misuse their power. But it's always clear. It's always clear. There's love behind what he says. That he wants for them freedom and reconciliation and life. And so he writes his book, Without Forgiveness, There Is No Future, or God's Dream, which is his most recent book. And he talks about expressing anger, but he says, let God tenderize that a little bit. That's my word, not his word. That as you speak your truth, speak it always in the hope that the relationship can be preserved. So this doesn't mean you tolerate injustice or you stay in an abusive situation. Absolutely not. You confront the evil.
You said that elders said there's no such thing as righteous anger, or there's no room for that.
Righteous anger, meaning the kind of anger the prophets had.
Okay.
where they raged. And they said, and Yahweh will say to you, I will be a bear and I will maul you. I will be a leopard. I will disembowel you. I'll just rip your guts out. And the elders would say, I don't think we should go there. You know, it's in the text. But we all read the scripture through our own hermeneutical lens. And we need to decide, what is this? See, their thing is always, is this bringing me closer to God? If I express my anger, is it bringing me closer to God? If I express my anger, is it bringing me closer to my brother and sister? Or is the opposite happening? Because if the opposite's happening, then I need to think about that. And the elders would say, maybe what you do then is you go to an elder. You go to an elder, a wise person. Maybe a nun. Maybe one of the grandmas who knits in the back of the pews and who's 80 and who puts out these little nuggets of wisdom. And you say, you know, I have this unresolved anger with my father. And when I'm around him, my gut just turns. And I've prayed about it. I've beseeched God, and I don't know what to do. Can you offer me any counsel?
So two questions. Yeah? They say that it's bad. I mean, when you have a fight, if I'm fighting with someone, if I'm mad at someone, I want to talk to them about it, fight about it, and get it done.
Right.
And clear the air and not have to tiptoe around each other for a week.
For sure.
Do they think that that's positive? Or are they saying that the anger in the first place shouldn't be
Well, bad? How do you fight? When you fight, how do you fight?
Teeth and nails. Talking.
Yeah, that's different. That's different. That's different.
So it's a different kind of anger than what they're
It's expressing about. It differently.
So would they think that Jesus, I keep thinking about Jesus in the temple throwing out the merchant. So that would have been a different, that's not anger in the sense that they're talking about
that's,
anger?
That's one of those great passages that I don't know what they would do with that. And somewhere in their sayings and their sermons and their writings, they probably got commentary on. But I don't know. But let me give you an example out of my own kind of family. My family did not deal with anger very well. My mom was a pouter and a whiner, and she'd get quiet and she'd withdraw. And my father was an absolute volcano. I mean, if you crossed him, he could knock you across the room. So I didn't have very good models for learning to express my anger. And when our children were growing and they were making choices that were not healthy for them, I was really clear, I didn't want to be like my mom. I didn't want to whine and pout and cry. And I didn't want to explode. I didn't want to rage like my father. And so what I would do is I'd write letters to our children. And I'd say, this is what I'm really upset, and this is why, because, and it's hurting your mother, and I'm fearful, and they would say, oh God, we didn't know. You know, and then we were able to have a conversation. But I didn't know how to start having a conversation and not just totally lose it. You know, and put my foot in my mouth. You know, or make them feel bad but not maintain the relationship. So that's a tool that I use to communicate with our own children. And now they do that with us. They'll say, hey, mom and dad, you're probably worried because da-da-da-da, but you know what? I'm careful. I know what I'm doing. I know you pray for me. Okay, love you. Da, da, da. So, you know, we're able to have those conversations. So I'm expressing, I'm getting it out. Because anger is a secondary emotion. behind it is fear or pain or, you know, another emotion is going on. Am I speaking at all to your question, sort of? Did you say you had two questions?
Wouldn't it be, I mean, I thought of the same thing, Jesus in the temple, but you said they had, it was about being loving.
Right.
And his intention of the anger. I mean, maybe the way he dealt with it, but he didn't condemn those people, like, he still loved them. He was just teaching them this, and maybe sometimes you have to get a message across in a certain way to certain people, but he wasn't violent, like, he didn't hit somebody.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting in the medieval art that portrays that temple incident. If you look at the text, some of the art distorts the text, and Jesus has the whip in his hand and he is threatening the money changers. But in other pictures, he's overturning the tables and the animals are, you know, he's sort of shooing them out, kind of, you know. He's turning things upside down, but he's not taking the whip to the people. And again, I think just out of my own journey, if you have just a little bit of anger, it grows. So it needs to be dealt with somehow. If you hold something against a person.
So the Desert Elders are really basically trying to teach people how to deal with the anger constructively.
How to be compassionate.
Not to have anger.
Not to have it, right.
Well, right. Isn't anger energy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
So if we get depressed, I mean, if we don't allow any of that. I mean, you know, somebody makes us angry or says something that just arouses me.
Right.
So we need to respond immediately.
For sure, for sure.
Check it out. What?
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
It's
assuming that gets us.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think of the person who works in the workplace, in the public sector. You pick up bits of anger from relationships, and the customers go on by. You can't ever catch one to resolve what made you angry. You carry a lot of that home. So I think if you let that energy then be used constructively through talking with anyone who's loving and kind, get it expressed, work through it. That person doesn't have to be threatened, but you've expended it and satisfied it somewhat. If you can find someone in the world who will listen to you lovingly, but you can't always catch the person who you've worked the anger.
Right.
Well, it's like, you know, sandpaper in our lives. Scott picked one of his books. reminded me. Use that term. Anger shows us if we reflect what we need to work on in us.
Often.
Now, why did I get angry? Oh, I'm proud. My ego is bruised. So it's a good thing. It's expressive.
I had a couple of thoughts. So years ago, I took a class, and this buildup of anger during your day or something like that, whether it's in traffic with the officer, and I was told that, like in traffic or somebody cuts in front of you, verbally say warm regards. And kind of, you know, you verbalize a little bit and it gets it off your shoulders. Just warm regards. And then you can start thinking about something
nice.
And the other thing that is an example of our family, we talked about your father. My dad had a hot temper. And I think it's in the genes.
Probably.
Because I have also, sometimes I can explode too. But the trouble is, I can see it in our older son. We have two boys. The younger son is much more mellow. The older son is much more like me. And I can see this anger all of a sudden come into a rage. And when I see that, if I'm around him, I try to talk to him. I try to say, hey, Bill, let's watch that. I said, that's not going to help you in your life. I learned by my experience. Handle it differently. So I verbalize it.
Honor the delivery, you know, so that you honor the person that you're angry at. If you can do that, still
yes, you're angry, but I don't think anybody sets out in their day to say, I'm going to make them so mad by doing this. You're just kind of caught up in your own world and you're ending up stepping on their feet. You didn't do it intentionally. Mm-hmm. And if you can view it that way, that they're not out to just really get you. Of course, different situations are
sure.
different, but I think it's all in the delivery of how you present that to them. My dad was a master at that. He was upset with me. He'd pull me aside and he'd say, I care so much about you that I want you to listen to me for a few minutes. And it was, I care so much about you, just kind of diffused the whole situation right away. And then I could listen to him. I wasn't, it wasn't, I am so mad at you.
Yeah.
You see, what, you see
right.
the difference?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You had your hand up in the back. So in sort of wrapping up this particular emotion, the elders would say, use the scriptures, pray the Psalms. They would often pray the laments. You know, God, why have you forgotten me? My enemies are doing this to me. They're doing that to my people. They would say, practice meditation, practice contemplation. Talk to an elder, and as you have angry thoughts, try and catch them before they get away from you. You know, if you can feel your gut kind of tightening up when someone says something or does something, you have a choice. You can feed that, or you can let it go. And their goal is to have the mind of Christ, to have the heart of Christ, to reflect that to other people. Depression, or they called it dejection. But basically this is anger expressed outwardly, and this is anger turned in. What causes depression? What are some of the things that cause depression? Okay.
Well, it can be situational if you have a loss, but I think there's also a genetic predisposition.
Biochemical?
Yeah, biochemical.
Genetic, okay. Is one, and I think another, another is situational. If you're in a situation where you're being devalued, or ridiculed or attacked, or you're not reaching your potential, maybe then you have to move. You know, what other things cause depression?
Stress overload.
You just got so much on you. Fatigue. Okay, that your body starts to kind of melt down. What else might cause depression?
Any kind of loss. Loss of someone near you, loss of identity or purpose.
Okay. Loss of identity, loss of purpose, loss of a person. Anything else?
Learned helplessness, a pattern of helplessness or feeling out of control.
Okay. Learned pattern of helplessness. Victimized.
Feeling out of control.
Feeling out of control. Out of control.
But that being a learned pattern.
Sometimes I say to people when they come for direction and I listen to them, I'll say, you have some options. And they'll say, really? And I'll say, yeah. Well, like what, for example? So I'll list two or three and they don't want to go there. So I just stop. But as they leave, I may say to them again, remember, God has given you the ability to make some choices. And people will support you. And you need to choose what brings you life, not what stifles you or stifles your spirit. I think the loss of a dream can cause depression.
when you see yourself moving somewhere and all of a sudden the door closes, and then maybe it closes again and again, and you think, man, I am stuck here. I am stuck here. And I had a colleague who that happened to, who could not get a call. And he was not nice to be around. He was not nice. He was caustic and abrasive and sarcastic. And finally, one day in a worship service, he just fell apart. He just fell apart. And he had to go to the hospital. And he couldn't finish the liturgy. And then he realized the problem was not out there. That the problem had taken up residence. And a woman came from his parish to see him, and after he was out of the hospital and he was on some meds, and he was still, you know, still not very integrated, and she just took his hands and she said, "I pray that the light of Christ will shine." And that's my prayer for you. And he heard that. He heard that. And he held on to that. Because depression is kind of like wearing sunglasses. You know, we see everything in gray and darkness, you know? And it's, whether it's biochemical or it's situational or it's grief, or maybe it's a sin. Maybe we've done something and we just can't believe that we had that abortion, you know? Or we can't believe that we're married and we love our partner and we had an affair. Or we can't believe that we betrayed a trust. That we betrayed a trust. And a friendship ended. And we just get into that downward spiral. And the Abbess would say, one of the resources available to us is to confess our sins. To name it, if we were partly at fault in what has broken this relationship, or this congregation, or this office, or classroom. One of the things the elders also say about depression is that it is not the time to be alone. It is not the time to be alone. It's the time to be in community. It's the time to tell other people you need them. And it's the time to practice your faith, how the best way you can, to pray the best way you can. If you use a rosary, if you use an icon, if you light a candle, if you use the Lexio, if you use the Examen, if you use the Jesus Prayer, but to do whatever you can. And God will bring you through the darkness. What a great thing to have a friend who would say to you, "I will pray that the light of Christ will come into your darkness." He couldn't ask for that. He wouldn't ask for that. He was too proud to ask for that. See, but this woman knew what he needed. She was an elder, although she was a young woman. She was an elder. She was also a nurse. Commoners. Questions?
And the things that we've been talking about suggests to me this question about reading these ancient texts, that contemporary psychology, contemporary medicine, popular culture has certain ways of thinking, particularly, and when I look at that list, particularly about anger and depression, that aren't the same ways. And you said that initially, that their cosmology and their anthropology is quite different. Would you say something about how we make that translation? And you did that kind of, when I say you were slippery about it, I don't mean that you were deceptive, but, you know, you went from depression as something that's treated medically,
uh-huh,
to depression that's caused by sin, It seems to me the remedy for these is not necessarily the same remedy. So how do we read these ancient texts into contemporary situations, knowing that the concepts, though they may have the same names, aren't necessarily the same things?
My understanding so far is that the Abbas would say, to the degree that it's possible, try and figure out the source of the anger,
mm-hmm.
or the source of depression. Where is it coming from? And it may be multiple sources. But then talk to someone about that. A physician, a confessor priest,
mm-hmm.
an elder. Draw on the community to help you come to some washing away, some purity of heart. There are the tension points, like righteous anger versus, you know, they say the goal is to love. The goal is to love. And they weren't always loving. They had their extremes. You know, some people went off the deep end in the desert. And I think there are tensions with modern psychotherapy. My hope is that when you read anything, I remember being at a workshop with M. Scott Peck, and he said, whenever someone is talking to you or you're reading something, ask this question: what are they not telling me? What are they leaving out? What are they leaving out? Like Foster says, the people who are word-centered tradition may leave out the contemplative tradition. They have their strengths, but they have their weaknesses. The contemplative tradition may leave out the social justice tradition, the taking the faith to the street kind of. So we need to be in conversation and to be discerning. And again, when I'm angry, I'm not discerning. I can't discern. I'm just thrashing. Speaking for myself, you know, whether it's going out or it's inward. Yeah.
I was just thinking, you started out talking about noticing thoughts, and one of the ways that depression is treated is cognitive therapy, where you actually try to find out what thoughts or beliefs that you have about yourself or your surroundings are giving rise to these negative judgments that, you know, there's no hope. I'm a loser, everything is bleak. And so, I don't know, I mean, there might be some real fruitful conversation along those lines.
Thanks. The elders also talk about the importance of beauty. I remember doing a long retreat with the Jesuits in California, and I walked into a nun's office, and she had a picture of a flower on the wall, and below it said, never be in a room where there's no beauty. That somehow, you know, think those things that are good, true, beautiful, positive, hopeful. Take that into yourself. The elders have another practice called guarding your heart. You know, have you ever watched something, maybe a movie or a video, and you just began to feel like, oh, this is too heavy? You know, they'd say, get up and walk out. Get up and walk out. You know? If you're in a party and there's stuff happening and you're thinking this is a bad scene, protect your heart. If you're watching, I was watching a movie with our kids, and it was, I don't know what it was called. It was at a family reunion over Memorial Day, and it was on humor. And it just got raunchier and raunchier and raunchier. And I just thought, this is not healthy. And our granddaughter looked at me, and I got up and I left. You know? And I wanted to say, she shouldn't be watching this. She shouldn't be listening to this. But I'm not her parent, you know? And I didn't want the kids to say, oh, don't be a pastor. You know, but I couldn't, I had to leave, kind of. So we guard the heart, we note the thoughts, the things that pull us from God, that pull us from the other, that pull us from our best self. And we, so maybe in food, instead of gluttony, it's fasting, it's moderation. In terms of sex, it's chastity or faithfulness to one person. In terms of things, it's simplicity. You know, so they have antidotes. We're at our time. Thank you. Thank you.